Okay, let's go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody. What a really fun, strange trip this has been this semester, going through the book of Ecclesiastes. I don't know if it's the kind of study that you might have expected, actually, to go through, because it's one of those that sort of its meaning and its message have been a little, it's a little out of the norm. If you're used to, you know, the sort of smiley, happy, Sunday school lessons that sort of end in Jesus, and we all smile and walk away. Ecclesiastes is just not really that. So that's why we're trying to sort of look at it, though, because it's actually in the Bible. And so there must be some wisdom there that we're supposed to uncover. In the last couple of weeks, we've been unpacking this whole idea of what the writer of Ecclesiastes is writing of life under the sun. And what I've tried to say is that little phrase under the sun is in many ways the way in which modern secular man is trying to view the world, okay? In other words, if you look at life under the sun as if all, this or what we can see, taste, touch, smell, feel, and hear is all there is, then you have what the writer of Ecclesiastes is trying to evaluate. Does that make sense? Which is exactly what our society is trying to do. We are living in the midst of a season, a parenthesis in time, if you will, where our culture, Western world, whatever you want to call it, is attempting to build a life of meaning and a life of clarity and understanding and fulfillment with no reference to anything outside of our own experience or life under the sun. Which is why I just simply wanted to do two or three Sunday school lessons here at the end of this time in talking about the way in which Ecclesiastes in many ways is one of the best tools we have to talk to our culture that is secularizing. Does that make sense? In other words, if you've got Ecclesiastes in its basic message, you'll know a lot of how to talk to the upcoming generation, and you'll know a little bit more how to frame, as it were, what you see as the culture does secularize more. So what I want to focus on, though, this morning is this question that's taken up in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. And frankly, it's one of those that's actually really good to read. Is there anybody who has a really nice, loud, clear reading voice who'd be willing to read Ecclesiastes 2, 1 through 11? Anybody feel like that? That sounds great. Davis, everybody's pointing at you. Do you like doing that or something? I don't know why Kennedy's pointing at you. All right, so stand up. I want you to stand up and do this here. So Davis just got engaged last night. So this is one of the, this is like the initiation rite for that. So we're very excited. David's first official act after being engaged is to read scripture in Sunday school. So, chapter 2, 1 through 11. Yeah, nice and loud. There it is. Nothing to be gained. Well done. Okay, let me ask you a question. This is the audience participation portion of the program this morning. So I wonder how many of you would be willing to share with the group what you think your best moment was. And I don't mean your best moment where you sort of pulled off something great or whatever, but when you were in the midst of it, you were thinking, you know what? This is living. Some time in which you are like, man, this is the best moment that I can remember myself having in terms of joy and in terms of delight and in terms of enjoyment. Like what, can you remember a time, maybe a season, maybe of something recent where you were really saying, man, this is what really does it for me. This is what makes life worth living right here. And don't give a spiritual answer either. Being here at church this morning. Come on. Tell Kitty, that's a great moment. Are you sharing something specifically about yourself? Can you share anything about that moment, that time, that season? Was there a moment? Yeah, I decided to muscle on you there. You're the one who offered it.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Joel. Kitty, tell us how much you love Joel, because Joel is in need of some affirmation this morning. Yeah, exactly right. There's just something where you found your person, right? I found my person. I'm going to be with this person. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. Yeah, and you start to think like I have discovered sort of the meaning of life. I mean, let's be honest. Did you get emotional last night when you got engaged? This is amazing. We're now going to put your engagement under a microscope for Sunday school. This is very cruel. We're doing some therapy is what we're doing. But really, in that moment, you get weepy when someone looks at you and says, yeah, will you be with me forever? And you're kind of like, yeah, I will, you know? And that moves us like crazy, right? What else? What is other things? Well, falling in love, that's a big one. Yeah, Karen?
The other end, last year, we celebrated 50 years.
50 years.
Around us, and they each one stood up and said something nice about us.
Karen, what were some of those nice things they said? I know that's really why you told that story. So, isn't that so great? Yeah, I'll say this. So right now, my wife is on her way to Memphis to pick up Caroline, my Seattle-born daughter, to bring her home. And like, yeah, I'm in a really good mood because by Tuesday, Lord willing, Anna Grace, my oldest, will be back home from Nashville, and we'll have everybody under one roof. And it's just really awesome. It really feels good, even when they don't say nice things about you. But of course, on your 50th anniversary, yeah, didn't you sit there and you think to yourself, okay, I'm not a screw-up. Here are these people who I like being around. I actually enjoy my children. We don't have any in-laws yet, but we keep hoping. You know, we're waiting for those boys and girls to come along when we want to expand the family. So, what else? What you got, Judy?
Life is great for us right now. Our kids live here. We're about to have 3 grandchildren.
That's it. I was about to say, if some of you don't mention grandbabies, then you're lying to yourself. See, I don't have any experience of this, but I remember my father very clearly looking at me and saying, yeah, God gives you grandchildren to make up for what it's like to have children, because it just sort of erases all of those things from the past. Yeah, it just feels so wonderful. Everything kind of comes together, and you're like, oh, this was it. There's another generation. I'll be honest with you. I remember being in the all 3 of my children. How do you know you were born in a small town? All 3 of my children were born in the same room. At Baptist Hospital. So I was like, when it was Luke's time, I was like, well, here we are again. But I remember having this overwhelming feeling. You feel a little eternal when you have a child because you're like, something of me is going to go on, right? Yeah, what else?
I was going to say when I
was... My voice went on.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, through that. Oh, Jane, that's a wonderful story. Talking about how... Yeah, I may come back to that, Jane, and we'll pick on you and let the illustration, because I think that's very key to what happens with some of these joys, is that they shift a little bit over time in different ways. What a great story. Okay, look, my guess is, and of course, I'm the Sunday school teacher, so I'm going to say something that none of you in a million years would ever say, but let's be honest, there's all kinds of pleasures that we look at to deal with when life feels meaningless or drab or not fun or depressing. There's a great scene in, and by the way, again, so much of our notes, especially when we get to the C.S. Lewis portion in a minute, look up what Tim Keller has done on Ecclesiastes. He's got a sermon series that he did, 22 years ago, which is all these comments are from. But Keller quotes a scene from the movie Radio Days. It's a Woody Allen picture. I don't know if you ever saw this years ago. It's a 35-year-old movie. And in the opening scene, you know, Allen always puts himself into his movies in some ways, and it's always this neurotic little character who's trying to deal with the existential realities of life around him. And this little boy goes to school one day, and he finds out from the teacher that, you know, the universe is all there is. And he completely is spun out into depression and misery because he's walking around to his parents and he's like, don't you understand that all of this is going to end? There is nothing really, life means nothing. We're all just going to spin out into non-existence, right? It's going to burn up and one day it's all going to be over. You know, does anyone care about this? Well, the mother is so upset. She brings the kid to the counselor. And he says this to the counselor. And the funny thing is when you watch the movie, you tend to expect for the counselor to say something to the child, which you and I would say, which would be like, no, don't worry. No, there is something out there. There is a reason for living. There's eternity. There's timelessness. There's God's truth. There is something out there. But instead, what the counselor does is, it just simply looks over and it's kind of like, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's just all it is. But you know what? There's a way to live this life that can still make it okay. So what do we tell ourselves when we start to face and feel this creeping meaninglessness of life? Well, what Davis read for us this morning was what the teacher, the Koheleth, does in response to that, because he says, let's go to pleasure. He goes to pleasure. His idea is, in pleasure, there is something that is promised to us that hopefully will stem the gap, right? So, you know, when we're a child, we look at things like, well, you know, we tell ourselves, oh, just lighten up. This is not that big a deal, we tell our children. We might look and be like, well, I tell you what, why don't we just go get you an ice cream cone? I know you're sad. Let's just get you a little something. Or, hey, why don't you and I go out and just throw the ball around a little bit, right? That's what we tell ourselves as children that sort of appease us. But as we get older, we need more, don't we? We're like, you say, well, you know, why don't we're just going out tonight. Tonight we're going out and we're going to forget it all. We're going to drown our problems. We're going to go out. We're going to find you somebody to kiss. I remember this is what you taught us here from college students. We're going to find you somebody to make out with. That's going to make it better. Right? The funny thing is none of you actually mentioned, for reasons of propriety, that sex is one of those things, right? Sex becomes one of those things out there by which people can appease themselves and make themselves feel to some degree that life has meaning because it's pleasurable, right? There's a pleasure that I go to. We could look at someone and say, you know what you need is you need a vacation. Let's go climb a mountain. Let's go look out across a view, you know, and just see something that's just overwhelmingly beautiful. And the funny thing is we go and do those things and we kind of feel a measure of healing, don't we? We take a long walk in the woods, maybe. Maybe we go out and go fishing. We'll go out and go fishing. Here we go, Toby. I'm connect with you over here. Get that John boat out there. We'll just be out there. Oh, my goodness. I finally found where there's finally pleasure here. But what happens is we go to these things simply because, and look at verse 3 there. He says there, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Okay, so you hear what he's saying? He's not just going for the simple pleasure. He's going to it for a sense that life feels worthwhile. Why keep living and not kill myself? That's really what he's asking. And I realize that sounds like very depressing. But you know what? In Christmas time, I've learned that people are grappling with these kind of things. So what he's saying is since we live in a world, we're living under the sun. Of course, this is the modern Western world here. Because we live where there's no objective meaning in life, nothing that's absolutely true, what we can go to is something that is subjectively meaningful. It's happy for me. It makes me happy. It gets me fulfillment, right? But here's what the writer is saying, and this is my only point I want to get together. I want to illustrate it with Lewis here in just a second. If that is what you are going to pleasure to get, you're going to find life getting very complicated very quickly. To the person who has said, you know what? Yeah, it's all just a crapshoot. It's all just, we're rolling the dice here. We're doing whatever we can. That's all that we can really conjure in this life. The truth of the matter is, let's just go have fun. Let's just go have a great meal. None of you mentioned meals, by the way. I've got a handful of like my top 5 meals of all time that I sat down and was like, I can't believe what's happening to my mouth right now. It's a wonderful meal. But those things carry us, right? I'm still talking about those experiences. And we do because we want for those things to sustain stuff. But here's what the writer is saying. Once you give yourself to pleasure, though it promises you subjective meaning to carry you through, you begin to find that something changes. All he's saying is, it's not the pleasure that I'm after. The pleasure is not the end. The pleasure is a means to an end. These experiences that I want to have are not just physical. They are spiritual. This is what people oftentimes don't understand about alcohol, right? I find myself relief in alcohol, but the alcohol is trying to get me someplace else. It's trying to get me to a place of meaningfulness or something that makes life worthwhile, which is namely, I got a timeout. We drink and become alcoholics because we hope in that drinking, we've got a simple relief. Now, some of you are jumping ahead. Don't do that just yet. I want you to think about this. What you find is there's always kind of a freneticness that's going to accompany people who have decided to simply live for pleasure. And society's always had pleasures, but never has there been in the history of humanity a society that has decided to build itself on a desire for pleasure the way in which ours has. Verse 2, very interesting, mentions two different kinds of pleasures. Look at what it says in verse 2. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? Now, those are actually, interestingly enough, two Hebrew words. I did this looked some of this stuff up. So laughter means sort of like an explosion of joy, sort of orgy-like loss of discernment, right, is what the laughter stands for. Pleasure, on the other hand, is the Hebrew word it's got a sort of a sense of more refinement. It's more aesthetic. In other words, somebody may be going to sort of a sex shop, you know, in the downtown part of your city. Another person may go to the opera. Okay, there's highbrow and lowbrow pleasures that humans go after. But in the end, the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, I've been to both. You know, whether I was on the Oprah Winfrey Show or whether I was on Jerry Springer, I've been to both of those kinds of pleasures. And somewhere in the midst of that, whether it was uptown or downtown hedonism, it all came up. It was making promises to sustain me, but it didn't, right? And that's the thing that we want to get to this morning that I want to spend a little more time on. Good, we're on time here. Because what's unique about Koheleth is he's a very unique person in the sense that he's tried everything. He says, I went to everything that there was in order to sort of conjure up meaning in my life, everything. And the funny thing is most of us never get there. This is one of the great problems and why we really need to listen to the writer of Ecclesiastes. For most of us, we get some pleasures, but we always know somebody else who's got the better stuff. Who's got the bigger boat, the bigger lake house, the better vacation, the more trips to Europe, or whatever it is, the pleasure you're tied to. And what we do is we spend ourselves pining, looking and thinking, well, the reason why pleasure has failed me is because I've just not found the right one. But Koheleth has come along and been like, hey, I promise you, I've been to them all. I saw and experienced everything, which 99.999% of us can't say, but he can. This is one of the reasons why people think that there's lots of historical reasons to think why Solomon was the one who wrote this. Solomon had everything. He ran over one of the largest sort of cultures during his time and was wealthy beyond measure. But here's what he's saying. He said, at the end of it, I was going to all of those pleasures for worthwhileness. For something transcendent that would drag me out of the misery of daily life. In other words, what he's saying is my pleasure that I was going for was an attempt to kind of do an end run around life always feeling so meaningless. That's what it was. And so what he says is what's going to happen, though, if that's how you approach pleasure is it's going to fail in a couple of ways. The first way it's going to fail is it's going to fail to distract you. Because again, subjective pleasure is trying to sort of cover over and say nothing to see here of your lack of objective pleasure. Keller says, and he's borrowing a line from Lord of the Rings on this one, where he says it's a little bit like trying to spread too little butter on a piece of bread. You just kind of run out. That's Bilbo's quote, by the way. He feels like too little butter spread across too much bread. And eventually get to the end and all the butter is gone. He says, if you try to find pleasure that's going to cover over that sense of meaninglessness, it's actually going to fail to distract you. And C.S. Lewis is the one who kind of brought us into this, I think, in wonderful ways. Because Lewis is basically saying, let's assume that all there is the material world. All there is life under the sun. He says, so this meaningless play of atoms in space and time by a series of 100 chances has regrettably produced things like ourselves. Okay. He's assuming, by the way, that we're materialists, right? Secular scientific worldview. We're just, you're a lucky chance. That's all you are. You're a happen chance of atoms coming together. And it regrettably has produced someone like you. Conscious beings who now know that their own consciousness is just an accidental result of a whole meaningless process. That is modern secularism right there. It is therefore itself meaningless, though to us, alas, we feel significant. Isn't that fascinating? In this situation, you might decide simply to have as good time as possible. Okay, that's where it starts. This basically is walking us through Ecclesiastes' experience. He says, but, this is so good, you can't, except in the lowest animal sense, be in love with a girl, and you know and you remember that your view of the world means that all of the beauty of her character and her person are a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the pattern of collision of atoms. And your own response to them is only a sort of psychic chemical phosphorescence arising from the behavior of your genetic material. That's all that is. Oh, kitty, whatever. Well, that's not love. Love is just atoms colliding in your consciousness. How great would it be if we came up to our young engaged couple and been like, oh, whatever. you're just atoms colliding together in meaningless existence. Psychic chemical phosphorescence. That's, you should cross stitch that and put that up in your home sometime. This is what Lewis is saying. He's saying, well, no, don't go there. That's too far. You went too far. What happened? Oh, no. Okay, I got to read it now because I forgot to put it up here. Oh, I'm terrible. That's what he says. And you can't go on getting very serious pleasure from music if you remember that its significance is a pure illusion. Lewis is saying, let's say you've got music that you just listened to. I guarantee you've done this. You've gotten in your car or you got home and you're like, I am listening to something. You're going for the distraction. Or maybe you're going for an amplification. And so you put in some music. Maybe it's going to calm me. Music hath charms, right? He says, but you only like it because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it. That's all that happened. I mean, for no reason, it was a complete chance. Your nervous system decided like, oh, I really like that song. Yeah, you may still in the lowest sense have a good time, but just so far as it becomes very good, just so far as it threatens to push you, this is the phrase I want to lock in on for just a second this morning, just so far as it may push you from cold sensuality on into the real warmth and real enthusiasm and real joy, so far will you be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your own emotions and the universe in which you think you live. Here's what he's saying. The first time I heard this, 20 years ago, I cannot keep messing with it. All pleasures in life can never be pleasures by themselves, because pleasures are always suggesting something. They're always saying something. They're always holding out hope to you. A pleasure of any kind, be it food, be it music, be it sex, be it relationship, companionship, whatever we go to say, this is going to be the pleasure, it's always holding out hope. And what Lewis is saying and what Ecclesiastes is saying is that can only function in your life as real medicine as long as you only think about it in the most shallow sense. Because the more you really think about it, the worse it's going to get. Which is cruel, isn't it? It's a cruel fate to often have a pleasure hung out there in front of you that you get to. Let's take, for instance, and y'all are going to be like, why did I come to Sunday school this morning? But bear with me. Walk with me through just about a minute of this. This week, my intention is, and all of my joys are wrapped up this week in having Anna Grace and Caroline and Luke and Ginger all around a table having dinner together as, you know, life was supposed to be. We're going to have that sort of sense of family coming over. I'm excited about that. But here's the deal. If all that I have is that, if that's all that I have, if that's the end, and there really is no absolute meaning, don't you realize that if I sit there and mull over that, if I swim in that, if I decide to really be like, man, why does this feel so good? The one thing that's going to occur to me is this simple fact, and that is that one person sitting around that table is going to see to the death of every other person around that table. I told you were going to be like, wow, this was great, Les. Appreciate the happiness boost. But all I'm trying to get you to see is, yes, find those pleasures, but then start to think about those pleasures, and they'll betray you. They'll turn on you. They'll leave you. The writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, if this is all there is, it's going to betray you. Here's what, this is what Lewis says. He says, so far you will be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your own emotions and the universe in which you think you live. We sit down, we fall in love, and we write poems because we want them to make us feel transcendent. But the more that I think about that, you try to think about that all the time. By God's grace, we have had what we would describe, both of us, to be a happy marriage. But again, that's part of the creepiness of getting older, is you're like, one of us probably, unless there's going to be some fiery car crash in which we die at the same time, is going to have to say goodbye to each other. I really honestly don't see how folks live with that. I really don't. We talk so glibly about being like, no, there's not a God. Who was I listening to this week that was just all up into their atheism? There's somebody on TV that was just funny about it. I can't remember who it was. But I just want to be like, look, I honor your right as a human being to decide, you know, on atheism. But do you not know what you've said there? If this material world is all that you have, like even your pleasures are going to betray you. In other words, it forces you to be superficial. So whatever I do, don't think about it. So yeah, have the pleasure, but don't ever think about that pleasure. But don't you see that's what the pleasure is inviting us into? That's what makes it pleasurable, is because I want to think about it. I want to mull over it. Don't do that. See the betrayal? This is where Lewis gets his second sort of set of quotes here under why it fails. Oh my goodness. He says, all of your life, there has been an unobtainable ecstasy. Yeah, here we go. An unobtainable ecstasy that has hovered just beyond the grasp of your consciousness. He's talking to a secularist at this point. There's something hanging out there, isn't there? Though often on the verge of breaking through, maybe when you're in the boat or when you're falling in love. That's Lewis's quote. That's not maybe when you're in the boat. Or when you're falling in love, when you are starting in on a pleasurable experience, you think, ah, finally, this is it. You're sitting over that meal and you're kind of like, man, this is what makes life worth living, right? When you finally say, this is it, and yet you never have it. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been but hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that just died away just as they caught your ear. It is the secret signature of each soul. Whew. He says, it is the incommunicable and unappeasable want to the thing that we desired before we met our wives or made our friends or chose our work, and in which we shall still desire when we are on our deathbed, when our mind is no longer knowing wife or friend or work. The books and the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust in them. It was not in them. It only comes through them. That is Jihugic, what he just said. He said, look, the pleasure was never meant to be the thing. The pleasure wasn't the thing. The pleasure was supposed to send, you were supposed to look through the pleasure to something else. He says, but if those things are mistaken for the thing themselves, they turn into dumb idols. It's an idol. That's the definition of an idol, a pleasure that we went to. Breaking the hearts of their worshipers, for they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of the flower we have not yet found. Isn't that a great line? The echo of the tune we've never heard. News from a country we've never yet visited. It is the music we are born remembering. There is a music we are born remembering and are trying to hear in music. There is a scent we are born remembering and we are trying to smell in a flower. Here's what Lewis is saying, and this is what I'll finish with. I'm out of time. I'm out of time. Holy mackerel. He's saying that pleasure was never meant to be on its own. Pleasure was pointing to something. And what it's pointing to is this simple knowledge that there must be an ultimate something. There must be a reason. Even a person who has said, I don't believe in your God. I don't believe in your rules. This is all there is, guys. You can look at them and say, okay, fine. Go to those pleasures. They're going to betray you. What else is alcoholism? What else is drug addiction? Then an inability to sort of say to those things, the pleasure is not the point. The pleasure is always pointing to something. And so here's the question that hangs over us. Are there enjoyments that you have that are not ends in themselves? You may have a pleasure that is, you know, like I get a joy in sort of straightening up my house, right? Because on the other side of that, I can take joy in the fact that like, oh, here we are, the house is clean. I've got an orderly place to live in before the guests come over or whatever it is. That's a pleasure that's sort of a means to an end. But the reason why I wanted to start the way I did is getting you to say, what are the pleasures that are pleasures in and of themselves? And I do think that there's an invitation in every pleasure that we pursue. This is my point. That God is saying, what would it be like to relate to me, not in a utilitarian sense? Do you know what I mean by that utilitarian sense? Like, How is God helpful to you? Now, this gets very confusing because God is absolutely very helpful to us. Someone is kind of like, my life is feeling meaningless. Oh, well, let me introduce you to the God of the universe. That might help. But somewhere in the midst of someone's spiritual development, what we're hoping for, and I think the writer of Ecclesiastes is pointing at this, he doesn't tell you, is that somewhere along the way, we're trying to find God being less utilitarian and just beautiful in himself. What if there is a God who, in the essential nature of his attributes, is all about making things new? I was talking to somebody about this just this week over coffee. God says in Revelation 21 that, behold, I am making, present tense, all things new. You have a God who is a hopeless romantic because he is absolutely an optimist. The God of the universe is an optimist because he's like, you know where the trajectory is heading. It's heading to everything being made new. And there's nothing uglier than a Christian pessimist, right? Well, I don't know. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. Okay, your world, your little space of time where Jesus carved you out to serve in his kingdom. But guess what? In the whole trajectory of things, he's making everything new. It's all going to be new. And here's the deal. That's one of the things that we want for pleasures. Let's be honest. What is Christmas except the opportunity to get something new? You're going to walk through Home Depot. Have you ever noticed how money doesn't exist in Home Depot? There's no cost too great. Well, of course, we need that. We have to have that. I don't know what it costs. Just get, you swipe it. Don't even think about it. Because we have to have it. Home Depot is what you have to have. Because it's going to be new. A new lawnmower, that new weed eater. It's going to be great. Wait till you see how good the yard looks, honey. Things we say to justify our wives, why we spend so much money at Home Depot, right? We want things to be new. There's a desire for newness. What is plastic surgery about? I wish I could hang on to newness, right? To cling to it. What's a new car? What's that new car smell really about? What does that smell? Every single day, every moment in the pursuit of pleasures, they are screaming to us the hopes that ultimately speaking, that life will never stop being new. It always calls itself away from it. All right, Ecclesiastes, you got as much as you can imagine. Any questions or thoughts in regard to that? Yes, yes. What you got, Rob? Turn on and drop out. Yeah.
The idea was that's how
he's talking about Timothy Leary in the 1960s, who was sort of a prophet of modern drug culture. Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. Once Timothy Leary sort of failed, then the Jesus movement follows right behind it because they knew there had to be a transcendence to it. Hey, by the way, that you triggered something, Rob, when you were saying that. You do realize that even though you're saying Sunday school is a little depressing today, Ecclesiastes is a little depressing. It kind of is. But you do understand that if there is a God, not only are those pleasures rescued in an earthly sense, that I can enjoy them within their proper parameters, and this is why God puts parameters around our pleasures, because he doesn't want you to sell your soul to it, because in the end, you won't experience the fullness of pleasure from it. What if God's commands are not ways to hem you in from pleasure, but a way for you to actually experience the fullness of it? Because if there is a God, it means now every tiny pleasure that I have screams to the forever pleasure. Ah, now when I fall in love, I realize that I was made for this. I was built for this. And one day, I'm going to experience a love that's more than I can ever even imagine. It's going to be poured out on me in immeasurable ways. Wow, I'm sitting here over this meal, and my goodness, it tastes good. Can you imagine what the marriage supper of the Lamb will taste like? In other words, every single pleasure that we have now doesn't get sort of diminished. It gets empowered and infused with something that otherwise it could never be. And again, same with Christmas. A lot of us like to walk around and be like, you're exactly right. Christmas is a waste of time. A bunch of foolishness and commercialism. I don't like how commercial it is. Okay, fine. But I'll say this, the nostalgic among us who sit there and stare at the Christmas tree lights, you ever found yourself doing that? Kind of quiet, Christmas tree's there, there's gifts all in. That's the way my little sunroom looks right now. And we sit there, we just kind of get lost. My children still do it. They'll still sit in there and just kind of wait. They'll look at their little phones while I got the Christmas tree in the background. And that nostalgia is calling us away to something. We actually know what that is. We know what that nostalgia is pulling us to. So in many ways, Ecclesiastes, it even saved Christmas. There. Ta-da. Okay. Hey, thank y'all for enduring this. Let's go ahead and close in prayer, and we will jump back into it here in worship. Lord Jesus, we are grateful for the witness of Ecclesiastes. That's kind of hard medicine, and for some of us, we have to do some work. We have to do some soul work where we start to really think about what we've been after all our lives. We have to think about this treadmill that we've been on, this rat race that we've been in. We do pray, Father, that you would rescue that, that somewhere in the midst of it, we would find, even in our pleasures, even in our work, even in our missions that we take on in life, that they all center and end and terminate in the knowledge of you, because you are altogether lovely, as Jonathan Edwards said. And so in you, Father, we pray in your face to find something that would bring us real joy. And maybe we could get a glimpse of that as we worship this morning. For we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.